ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
At the bottom of the Mediterranean, there are bodies, silent and still. They lie on the ocean floor. They have chiseled chests and big beards that are frozen in time, cast in marble and bronze. And at the turn of the 20th century, a diver stumbled upon them and thought, initially, they were spirits.
I've seen a ghost at the bottom of the ocean, and he kind of comes up and they start slowly pulling pieces up.
The 2,000-year-old statues are just some of the treasures found in a shipwreck. There's also ceramics and jewellery and a corroded chunk of metal.
And people look at it and they say, should we chuck it out? What is it? They couldn't really understand or see the value because absolutely nothing like this has been found since and had been found. But no one saw coming that out of all of those things that were pulled out of the ocean, that this one would possibly be the one that has gained the most media attention, you know, 2,000 years on.
My name is Mark Fennell, and this is the story of how that piece of metal, found in an old shipwreck, would eventually become known as the world's first computer, and it would transform how we see the past and how we see the present. And no one saw it coming. So, around 2,000 years ago, I want you to picture this, there was a ship sailing on the Mediterranean, making its way from Greece towards Rome.
So, in around 60 BCE, we know that there was a pretty large merchant vessel, it was probably about 40 metres long, that was making some sort of journey from Asia Minor, and then it was continuing west, but as it was travelling between kind of Crete and the Peloponnese, so that southern part of Greece, it went down, it sunk, and so it never arrived to its final destination.
And it turns out this ship was carrying some fairly special cargo. But here's the weird part. If you were to look at the ship on the ocean, it didn't look that great.
The other thing about ships in antiquity is you have to be careful of pirates. So you don't want to be looking too snazzy.
This voice, by the way, this is Dr. Tatiana Burr.
And I'm an ancient Greek cultural historian, which means I spend my time lecturing and researching and teaching about ancient Greece. And within that, because there's lots that encompasses, right, like literature and art and philosophy, I actually work in this little domain of ancient technology.
Now, Tatiana has spent a lot of time studying this particular shipwreck, with good reason. So what exactly was down there that more than 2,000 years later is still capturing people's imagination?
And so you have all of these objects hitting the sea floor. You have kind of banal ceramics that are just storage vessel, some oil lamps, which are quite, again, common objects. But then you have some really special objects. You have kind of jewellery, intricate jewellery. You have glass that was probably made somewhere either in Egypt or Palestine. You have coins that is useful because then we can kind of date as well the shipwreck using those coins. And then we have much bigger, more impressive pieces. So we have life-size marble statues and life-size bronze statues.
Today, you might not think twice about a life-size statue, but at the time, a bronze or a marble figure that is as tall and as strong as an adult was actually quite special because they are very rare.
Because we don't have a lot of life-size bronzes because often they didn't survive. People melted them down and reused them for things. And so the fact that we have big life-size bronze statues just sitting there at the bottom of the ocean floor for so long is kind of amazing.
Just so we're absolutely clear, Banal Ceramics is the name of my new indie band. I'm calling it now. You can play bass. We'll be great together.
Awesome.
It's interesting when we talk about this shipwreck because I have heard it described as like the Titanic of the ancient world. How do you feel about that descriptor?
That makes sense in terms of the size. I mean, 40 meters is a pretty big ship, but it was
bigger than I can afford.
But it was carrying lots of cargo, lots of expensive cargo rather than people. Mm. And it was not doing any kind of tourism, right? It was probably picking up the cargo that it had been commissioned to pick up and then heading for the destinations that it was going to in this particular period. Luckily, pirates had kind of been eradicated, but still, it's probably not wise to kind of build a Titanic and flaunt it when you're trying to cross like a large area of sea.
So this incredible collection of things from Banal Ceramics through to amazing stead. Yeah,
ceramicists are going to hate me.
All of these pottery people are coming after you now. But there, it stays in the bottom of the ocean for a really long time. And then 1900, 1901, something major happens, doesn't it?
So in 1900, 1901, you actually get Greek sponge divers who are not looking for anything in particular, but who, thanks to this kind of new technology that they can dive in, can stay for longer at deeper depths. And the stories are that they kind of come across this shipwreck and one of them looks into the face of this marble statue. And one of them is kind of this bearded figure. It's quite impressive. And you know, the story is that he's sort of like, oh my goodness, I've seen a ghost at the bottom of the ocean. And he kind of comes up and they start slowly pulling pieces up.
Slowly but surely, these priceless artifacts are picked up off the ocean floor. And there's antique glassware, jewellery, statues, ancient coins, and yes, Banal Ceramics. And in amongst all of them is a very curious trinket. It looks kind of innocuous, but they brought it up anyway. It turns out to be something so intricate, so complex, that it would take generations of people to make sense of it.
And towards the end of the excavation, in fact, you get this kind of piece of metal that gets pulled out. And people look at it and they say, should we chuck it out? What is it? Oh, wait, hold on. And they kind of notice that it has a little bit of writing.
Yes, this corroded piece of bronze had ancient Greek inscriptions on it. It took a sharp eye to see it first, but once they'd noticed it, it completely changed how people saw this thing.
And that's the saving grace for this object, because if it didn't have writing, it just looked like a kind of corroded piece of bronze. They couldn't really understand or see the value, because absolutely nothing like this has been found since and had been found.
So thanks to that writing, they decided to hold on to this object. I think probably because they wanted to understand it, to decode it, to decipher it, because really, besides the writing, it was pretty unrecognizable.
Yeah, it's difficult to describe because it just looks like nothing else, particularly nothing Greek or Roman. You know, we have images in our minds of statues or of pots or of other kind of fine ware perhaps. But this is just a bizarre chunk of metal. And in the end, there ends up being 7 fragments that are of decent size, but then 75 fragments that are tiny or minuscule. Mm. And all of that only makes up a third of the total object. So it really is this kind of jigsaw puzzle. And some of those bigger fragments, you have, for example, a fragment where you can see a circle with a sort of X on it. So it does look like some kind of wheel of some sort.
It looks like the X-Men logo.
Yeah.
It's just like really just waving the flag for being a nerd here. That's kind of what it looks like to me.
That's what the sponge divers thought at the time.
I'm sure
in 1901.
They did. Huge comic book fans, famously so.
Then there are some other larger fragments that have other pieces of a kind of circle. You could see it was originally a circle with maybe little markings along it, like little gradations. Some of them have little bits of Greek writing. Again, that gets people really excited because it's something that they can hold on to and try to decipher and understand.
It's one thing to translate the writing on this thing. It's quite another to figure out exactly what this object is. Now, remember, the divers found it around sort of 1900-ish. Years pass. Expert after expert tries to work out what this mechanism can be. Then you fast forward to the 1950s, and people are still scratching their heads. But that is when a British academic enters the story.
By the name of Derek de Solla Price.
Great name.
And
great
yeah. Name. Yep, I'll have to say the full name every single time I refer to him.
What? Hold on, what instrument is he playing in our band, by the way?
I'm the double bass.
You're double bass.
What are you?
I think I'm drums.
So is he our vocalist?
I think so. Let's go with that. So Derek de Solla Price, lead vocalist, but also Very important to the story, carry on.
Derek de Solla Price has two PhDs, you know, as you
That's showing up,
yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, geez.
He has one in the physics of metals and he has one in the history and philosophy of science, which makes him a kind of good candidate to try to figure out what this is, because it's an old piece of metal. he kind of gets really taken by this object. At one point, he even asks, he's working in the UK, he asks for the British Museum to please get it transported from Greece to him in the BM, and the Greeks refuse.
Oh, I'm shocked. Who could have seen that coming? You want to talk about things that no one saw coming.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or stuff the British didn't steal or didn't manage to. So he ends up having to eventually go to Athens to actually work on this mechanism. And in 1959, he actually releases a kind of popular article in the Scientific American. And this is when he says this is the world's first computer. It's the first time that this label gets attached to this gadget.
All right, hold on for a second here. How is a corroded piece of metal with, you know, some inscriptions from a shipwreck thousands of years ago suddenly being dubbed a computer? Like, how does that make sense? Well, it starts with the gears, right? So Derek de Solla Price, he looks at these layers of gears and he's starting to work out how they interact with each other. And he thinks they must be processing something. Computing, dare I say. And he becomes quite obsessed.
Painstakingly studying this object, hypothesizing how the different pieces could have come together. And so he writes this article. It gets a lot of traction. People get really excited in the 1950s to think that the ancient Greeks could have had a computer.
So the veil has now fallen. We've now given it the name, the world's first computer. In what way is this the world's first computer? Because I'm so intrigued. Because so far all I've got is pieces of metal, apocryphal X-Men logo, and we've got a lead singer for a band. But the actual object in its that we're describing, what did he work out that it was?
Yeah. So when it was first pulled out, people, thanks to the inscriptions, scholars thought maybe it's something to do with tracking the stars. That would make sense. You're on a ship, so it helps you navigate. That's logical. Then a little bit more work is done. They see that it's got something to do with the planets, and so they think maybe it's like a planetarium of some sort.
Teeny tiny one.
A teeny tiny planetarium, yes. And then with Derek de Solla Price's work, we actually see that it does so many more things than that. But what Price does is he shifts from trying to understand exactly what it is to understanding how it works. So he's really obsessed with these gears, these 69 internal gears that work with these, they're called precision gears. They're tiny. And actually, scholars didn't realize that the Greeks even had the capacity to build something like this. So it kind of blew open what the Greeks could do, technologically speaking.
I think this reveals a lot about us in the modern world and how we perceive ancient civilizations and technologies. I think we instinctively understand that they could build big things, you know, aqueducts and temples and stuff like that. But I think it's harder for us to process that they could make something intricate and detailed, like a mechanism with 69 interlocking gears with various cycles and speeds. And as more study happens on this ancient computer, we begin to get a clearer picture of what it would have looked like in its original form.
So if we imagine something about the size of a modern shoebox and then it had on the side like a knob or a crank, and that would allow you to spin the internal gears and to animate the surfaces. And there were essentially two sides to this mechanism. The front face, as we call it, had one dial. It had a representation of the Earth in the middle, and then it had seven pointers. One for the sun, one for the moon, and then one for each of the five known planets at the time. And those planets were wandering through an external circle that described the zodiac. So you see the planets kind of wandering through the Greek zodiac. And then there was a ring even outside of that that represented the Egyptian calendar. So you see the Egyptian calendar, the Greek zodiac, the planets, the sun and the moon.
It is a tiny, intricate tool to decode the known universe. But there's more, because on the other side, essentially it's a tool for decoding time. It's a calendar.
So it has two spirals. The top spiral is a lunisolar calendar, so you can track the date. And then within that, you have even more information. So something like a little dial that tells you which religious festival we should be celebrating that year. We all know about the Olympic Games. So the Olympic Games is one option, but then there are other games that the Greeks came together to celebrate. And it tells you, you know, every 4 years, which game it's going to be. And then the bottom dial is a spiral that has lots of cells, and most of them are blank. But every now and then you have one cell that's marked, and that is showing you when there's a possibility of having an eclipse. And that's actually based on a Babylonian eclipse cycle known as the Saros cycle.
Every time I look at pictures of this thing and then realize when it was made, it blows my mind.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's lots of different things that have been created over the years that have claimed the credit of being the world's first computer.
Mm-hmm.
And in their own way, they can all be correct, right? Mm-hmm. But what this offers us is this incredible picture of just how much ancient Greeks knew and what they could build. And it is an... It remains an incredible, groundbreaking discovery, right?
Absolutely. And it's not just how much the ancient Greeks knew, it's how much they collaborated with the cultures that were beside them, right? You see that Greek knowledge, but you also see them kind of try to translate or equate that with the Egyptian calendrical knowledge, with the astronomical knowledge from the Babylonians. And so it all comes together in this beautiful instrument. You asked me before if there was a term we could use to kind of refer to it. I like cosmos in a box.
The actual name of this mechanism is borrowed from the Greek island where the shipwreck was found, the Antikythera. The recovery of that shipwreck was, in fact, one of the first major underwater archaeological expeditions. But it kind of took a while, back in the 1950s, for people to realize just how amazing this discovery, this mechanism was.
It was a really slow process, Mark. So you have De Solla Price working in the 50s. He continues to work away at it. In the 70s, we're able to X-ray scan it, and that helps a lot because you can get kind of the depths of the level of the corroded metal all kind of congealed together. You can then start to see the little levels, and you can also see the inscriptions better. So that's a kind of one breakthrough. But it doesn't really get much media attention at that point. In 2005, you then get CT scanning of the object, and so then you sort of get a bigger interest. And in 2006, by this point, there's a big collaborative team that's working on this mechanism, and they publish a paper in Nature that actually makes people go pretty wild. But again, it's got the snazzy label of the computer attached with that.
Even though the Antikythera has been given the term of the world's first computer, to be honest with you, I don't think it quite captures, I guess, the ambition of the object. I think today, we think of computers as like fairly utilitarian tools, but the Antikythera has this sort of awe and wonder to it that I don't think the term computer quite captures.
It certainly doesn't conjure up the image of an object that's trying to allow a human to figure out what on earth the universe is about, which is a big part of this object, right? It is, I'm a human user, I'm looking up at the stars and I'm trying to understand what their movement means to me, what it means to the Egyptians, what a phenomenon like an eclipse could possibly mean, can I predict it? And if I can, is it still an omen?
That's a lot of things.
It's a lot of things.
I mean, you raised a really interesting point, which is that it isn't just a picture of ancient Greek knowledge. It also kind of reflects the collaboration between other cultures and faiths. In that regard, it is a bit of a cosmological Rosetta Stone as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is another thing that the label of the computer kind of hides, right? I think it's really nice to think about the different cultures and the different cultural knowledges and scientific traditions that are coming together in this object, and by calling it a computer, we do sort of ignore that, or we don't bring it to the fore as much as I think it probably deserves, because it's a big part of understanding how scientific innovation and collaboration worked in antiquity.
So this cosmos in a box, who made it and where was it going on that ship? Well, to those points, we don't have a lot of hard evidence, but we do have some great theories.
So the first thing is where it came from. And we have, in that game style that I referred to, that has the big Olympic games and the Delian games and other big games, we have a rather obscure game. So it's a festival to the sun god, and it's something that was celebrated on the island of Rhodes. And so some people say, which was also a kind of flourishing scientific centre, and so some people think it was a sort of stamp, like made in Rhodes, to have this little reference to this festival. So possibly it was made in Rhodes. That makes sense also with the kind of direction that the ship was going. And in terms of where it was going to, it's highly likely this was commissioned by an elite person who had the funds to kind of commissioned something like this and who would have had the interest in having what is essentially like a showpiece, because it's so intricate that it's tricky to make it work flawlessly for very long. You're going to have things in the mechanism that kind of need you to adjust them slightly. So it's probably better up on a mantelpiece than it is for you constantly cranking it.
And do we know where this fancy person might have lived?
People have said that it's likely the ship was heading to somewhere like Rome, given all of the luxury goods that it had on board. Particularly, this was a time where Romans liked to display like Greek statues in their cities. But there is also an internal possibility, which is that the calendar that I described on the back face is a calendar that's unique to a particular Greek city-state. Mm-hmm. And so people think that actually maybe it was going up to Epirus, which is a part of kind of Greece that is in line with modern Corfu.
So, arguably the world's first computer designed to decode the known universe. What do you think it really tells you about the past that we missed?
I think it's got various impacts at various levels. So, on the one level, it does genuinely open up the possibility of Greek technological potential. So people didn't believe that the Greeks could do this kind of thing. And so it makes us go back and assess the kind of other possibilities that have been lost. The other thing that it does is through these analogies or the comparisons with the computer, it allows us to kind of see a progression between analog coding, let's say, like this mechanism is doing a kind of analog coding into the digital coding, which does allow for a kind of development in thinking and in technologies, which is exciting. And the most obvious with that is kind of clockwork, right? The kind of mechanisms that lead to clockwork, which is similar to the internal gearing of this object.
Now that a gazillion people are aware of the Antikythera, thanks to you coming on this podcast and talking about it, what would you like people to think about when they think about that object that was pulled from the bottom of the ocean that reveals so much about ancient Greece and how it was connected to so many other cultures and just how much they could do that perhaps we did not know before? What is it that you would like people to think about when they see and when they inevitably Google pictures of it, which you should do, by the way, because it looks crazy? Mm.
One of the things that I would love people to walk away from this episode thinking about is the way that we don't need to have a single person, a single genius figure behind an invention. Mm. So this is such a good example of how knowledge production is collaborative. It's collaborative across time and it's collaborative across cultures. And although certain blockbusters would love to attribute this to Archimedes, there is no concrete evidence that this was built by him. And I think if we just sit with this idea that it was made by probably a bunch of people, enslaved and free, and that those knowledge traditions come from a really wide cultural cross-section of the Mediterranean at the time, I think we're left with a really rich picture of what ancient scientific developments can be.
Today, the fragments of the Antikythera mechanism are proudly on display in the National Archaeological Museum in Athens. Do you know, sometimes we look back to help us make sense of how we got here. And indeed, today we use computers smaller than the Antikythera for just about everything. They fit into our pockets and our wrists, and we use them for, let's be honest, a lot of boring things, like emails. I think the thing I love about this object, arguably the first of its kind, is that it is a reminder of the best of what technology, of what computers can be. This mechanism is an expression of our curiosity, an evidence of our ingenuity to decode that which we do not understand. It's an attempt to bring sense to a complicated universe. And I'm not sure that anyone along the way, the people who went down on the ship 2,000 years ago, or the divers who brought it back up more than a century ago, could have realised that.
And I think, nor did probably the person who commissioned it or the people who were involved in creating it, right? But no one saw coming that out of all of those things that were pulled out of the ocean, that this one would possibly be the one that has gained the most media attention, you know, 2,000 years on.
Dr. Burr, this was a place, you know what, we should do this again sometime.
With the band.
Yeah, with the band. All right, we'll get you back in a couple of weeks and we'll have the full band together. Deal. Dr. Tatiana Burr is a lecturer in classics at the Australian National University. And this episode of No One Saw It Coming was produced by Zoe Ferguson on Gadigal Land, Sydney for ABC Radio National. Before I go, can I ask you a small favour? If you are enjoying the show, please rate and review us. I'm trying to say that in a way that doesn't sound desperate, but at the end of every podcast sounds a bit desperate. In truth, it does genuinely help other people find the show. While we're at it, please let us know, like, directly what you think as well, what you're loving, what you'd like us to explore in future episodes. We love hearing from you. Our email address is noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. Also, if you're new to the podcast or you missed a week, go back through the episodes. We've got heaps you can binge on. The blunder that brought down the Berlin Wall, the real history of high heels, the origin of reality TV. You can find all of them on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Fennell, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.